You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. I hope that you had a great weekend. My husband is on a business trip right now and is staying at the La Quinta. Now, this is where they filmed the season of The Bachelorette. And in passing, he mentioned to me that he saw several camera crew. And so I asked him to take video and to take pictures and to send them back to us, back to headquarters, in the event that he's unknowingly on the front lines of some scandal or on the front lines of witnessing something having to do with the ending of the show. Now, I want you all to keep your expectations low, and here's why. This is the same guy who sat beside Jennifer Garner on a plane and didn't know who she was for a year. He just told me, I sat next to someone who seemed kind of famous with brown hair. So he could see, I don't know, several of the contestants walk by and he would have absolutely no idea who it was. So I have just asked him to just take random photos of anybody in the proximity of a camera crew. So God only knows what he's going to come up with. But I promise to post the evidence. In other news, I watched a great segment of Finding Your Roots. This is a great PBS series if you've never seen it. I love the show because Henry Louis Gates Jr., who is this Harvard professor, he does a lot of series on PBS that examine U.S. history. Well, in this one, he continues his quest to get into the DNA of American culture. So in each episode, celebrities view ancestral histories and sometimes learn of connections to famous or infamous people, discover secrets, share the emotional experience with viewers. So they're analyzing genetic code, DNA diagnosticians trace bloodlines and occasionally debunk long-held beliefs. And it's really fun to kind of see the celebrities, their reactions to seeing biographical information, a lot of it that was totally unknown to them, and particularly when they see the photos of their relatives. I remember this one episode, Seth Meyers is looking at a photo of, he turns this like album to look at this picture of his grandfather, and he's a dead ringer for him. I mean, they look exactly alike. And Henry says, how do you feel when you look at that picture? Does he look familiar to you? Because they look exactly alike. And he's like, I don't know, maybe a little bit around the mouth. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, are you blind? You're basically twins. So that's kind of fun too. Taya Leone just had an episode where she looks at a picture of her grandmother and her mom, I believe, had been placed for adoption. So all of this information about her grandmother is totally new to her. And she looks at a photo of her grandmother for the first time and realizes how much she looks like her mother. And it just takes her aback and she kind of takes it like a deep breath in and starts to cry. And you find yourself crying too, just thinking, wow, what an interesting, profound experience. So this last episode that I watched was fantastic. So Joe Madison is the celebrity that they featured. So he's this groundbreaking radio personality, a human and civil rights activist. He has a show called The Joe Madison Show. It's on Sirius XM. He's known as the Black Eagle because he talks about political and social issues, bringing attention to social injustices around the world. So he's always talking about social justice issues, particularly that have to do with Black America. So he discovers in the episode that his father is not exactly who he thought it was. And he's taken back by the information. And Henry, who is his personal friend, graciously says, you know, this, I know this is a lot for you to process. So he gives some time to process the information and then comes back to him, you know, weeks later or something, months later, which I thought was quite nice because some of these shows, it's like, and your mom's not really your mom. So here are your new cousins. And they like come around the corner and you're like, whoa, 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 wait. Like this stuff takes time to process. So they get to the point where he's got the photo album for him with all this information. And he says, we've located information about your dad. And here is a photo of him. And he turns the page and he goes, I know that man. He said, I don't know why, but this face is very familiar to me. So that was, you know, pretty compelling, just watching his face and just the realization that this is a story that probably resonates with so many people around the world, that you think that your biological or your parent is your biological parent, and then you find out this information. So he's looking at the photo and then it goes into his father. So his grandfather. So Henry, who's again, like clearly a very close friend of his, says, I want to share with you a story about your grandfather. He was a victim of a dark and shameful part of American history. And Joe kind of tilts his head like, what is it? And he says, the Tuskegee Institute syphilis study. And you see him take a deep breath and he's like, you've got to be kidding me. And you realize that there's this incredible life moment where someone who has studied so much about a significant part of history finds out they're somehow connected to it. So if you're not familiar with it, the Tuskegee Institute syphilis study, or sometimes called the Tuskegee study, was conducted by the U.S. Public Health Service from 1932 until 1972. So the objective of this study was to observe the natural progression of the sexually transmitted disease syphilis on African American men. The study was conducted on African American men, primarily poor and uneducated sharecroppers in Tuskegee, Alabama, which at the time had the highest syphilis rate in the country. So the participants were told that they were being treated for bad blood and were offered incentives in exchange for their participation, including transportation, free meals, free medicine for diseases other than syphilis, and burial insurance. So most had never had any access to healthcare. Well, approximately 600 men were enrolled in the study, and over 399 men were infected with syphilis, and 201 were disease-free. So participants of the study were never told they had syphilis and were only given placebos even after 1947 when scientists discovered that penicillin was an effective treatment for syphilis, which already you're like, this is unbelievable. So researchers withheld treatment for the disease even as men were tested upon entering the U.S. military and other recruits were tested and treated for the disease. So many participants died from the complications of syphilis, and many wives, girlfriends, and children contracted the disease. So researchers never shared the purpose of the study with the participants and did not follow any of the protocols of informed consent. So this study was terminated in 1972, so 40 years later, when a whistleblower, Peter Buxton, working for the U.S. Public Health Service, shared the study with the media. He had raised concerns years earlier within the Public Health Service to no avail, so he made this decision to share internal documents with journalists, so quite brave. So there was absolute public outcry, of course, which led to a congressional hearing and a termination of the study on the grounds that it was unethical and unjustified. So it took public outcry and a congressional hearing to terminate this barbaric study. So in 1974, a $10 million settlement was reached with the victims, which is how many? There were 600 people that were part of the study, and there was only a $10 million settlement. And the Tuskegee Health Benefits Program was created to provide benefits and medical services to all participants and their families. And then in 1997, President Bill Clinton issued an apology on behalf of the U.S. government to the 8 remaining survivors and descendants of the victims of the study. So here we have Joe Madison, who has probably talked about this study countless times. And he had no idea that his grandfather was part of the study. And then you get to see a photo of the grandfather. And he was almost not even included in the study because his skin was so light and he had light eyes that they didn't think he qualified enough as an African-American man, which is just, the whole story is crazy. And anyway, I just thought the friendship between the two men, that Henry gave him the grace to kind of unwind from the first part of the story that his biological father was not who he thought he was, and then to find out that his grandfather was part of this incredible, you know, study, a part of our American history. I just thought, how interesting. And then you think of your own life and there are stories that resonate with you in history. And to imagine that you found out years later that you are somehow connected to it is just really astounding. So I encourage you to watch that show, Finding Your Roots, but make sure you look for that episode with Joe Madison. This episode, I had the opportunity to talk to Becca Cuffrench. Now, she's best known for her role as the winner of the 22nd season of ABC's The Bachelor. She was the one that got engaged to Ari. And remember, Ari broke up with her in a rented house on national television. And then they announced her as the Bachelorette soon after. So she goes through all these guys. She's the lead for the 14th season of The Bachelorette. And then she eventually got engaged to Garrett. And they were together for quite some time, and then they recently broke up. So Becca shares what it's really like to be the Bachelorette. And you know me, I'm asking, like, what are you really doing in the fantasy suite? Because although you want to jump his bones, are you mindful that maybe they have an arrest warrant that you would be privy to, or should be privy to? Or, like, what are their finances and all that stuff? So I was really excited to talk to her about that. But I also wanted to ask her about how social media factors into the experience of being the Bachelorette. Because on paper, you're like, that seems pretty great. I mean, you have a stylist, you get to go on TV, you're on the cover of magazines, you get all these opportunities. But there's like this other dark side to it, that people are ruthless. And you guys know it on social media, that you could have somebody who's living in their house on the other side of the country and can say the most hateful thing without really knowing you, based on an assumption. So I wondered, like, how do you prepare for that? And does she give advice to other women that are in the same position? How to prepare oneself for the onslaught of praise one gets, but also the onslaught of negative feedback. And then I asked my dear friend, Jonathan Mark, who's a medium, to go through each case featured on season 2 of Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix. So season 2 just started airing last week, and we go through each episode. Now, this show highlights cases of perplexing disappearances, shocking murders, and paranormal encounters. So again, we go through every episode, and then at the end, I also asked him about the case of Madeline McCann. So here we go. Becca Cuffrin was, quote unquote, the winner of the 22nd season of ABC's The Bachelor, and then the lead of the 14th season of The Bachelorette. She's co-host of the Bachelor Happy Hour podcast. I have been dying for a long time to ask her about what it's like to be The Bachelorette, because I feel like she's a girl after my own heart. Becca, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, first and foremost. I'm so excited to be chatting with you. Man, that's a loaded question to start off with, asking me what it's like to be the Bachelorette. I mean, I'm a few years removed, so obviously things have changed a bit. But it's crazy. It's like the craziest whirlwind of a 2 months that you can ever imagine. I mean, you're whisked off to all these cool, extravagant countries and hotels, dating 20 plus men. So it's very exhausting, but so worth it, and probably for sure the coolest thing I've ever done in my life, I would say.
So you struck me as somebody who obviously you're very smart and you were active in politics. And so I think for a lot of us, we started watching and thought, okay, she's going to like give these guys a little run for their money. I mean, she's not going to just take anything they say. I was like, finally, somebody who's going to be like, I don't think so. So I have to ask, you're on like first go around, you're a contestant. So is it hard to separate yourself from the process to ensure that you're finding out whether this person was the best fit for you and not, I have to be the best fit for that person? So you're staying true to like, I have to find what's right for me and I'm not shaping myself mm-hmm. into what that person wants me to be. It, like under the confines of this TV show, I would think that would be really hard, especially at first.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I left for the show to be one of many of the girls on The Bachelor season, I left, I hugged my mom goodbye and she said, stay humble, stay kind, stay true to yourself. And so I really tried to channel that. I think when you are removed from your normal life, like, you know, when we come to film, our phones are taken away. We don't have TV. We don't have magazines. We don't have contact to our friends and family. So we're really living in a bubble, which I think it's easy to get wrapped up in. I think it's easy to get sucked into the drama between the contestants. And so for me, one of my main things was to just not focus on the drama. Like I really wanted to go there to see if this relationship could work. So I didn't want to get wrapped up into all of the like crazy pettiness that we see a lot of times on the seasons between the contestants. And so for me, like I needed alone time. I really wanted to go each and every day and take time to journal and to write down my thoughts, my feelings and questions that I had for The Bachelor to make sure like his answers aligned with what I was looking for. The hard part with that is because we are filming within a certain schedule, like we only get a certain amount of time with The Bachelor each week. And as you go further week by week, you have more time. But at the beginning, like I really went in with some hard hitting questions, like early on that weren't even shown because it didn't make for good TV, but I knew that they were important for me to ask in a potential partner. And so I'm glad that I did because it really helped me see, could this person fit in my life for the long run? Yeah, it's definitely easy to get wrapped up, but I feel like I was a little bit older of a contestant on that season, and so I kind of knew what I was looking for in a partner, what I wasn't looking for, and so I just could kind of shape my questions a little bit better when talking with him, if that makes sense.
Well, what kind of questions would you have in mind? Because we never see you guys have conversations that are about like finances or politics or in-laws, mm-hmm. like the things that we know, especially as a married woman, that really make or break a relationship. Are those conversations happening, but they just don't air them?
Yeah. I mean, at least for me, they were happening. And I think for some of the other contestants, they definitely did happen, but yeah, it doesn't make for good TV. So like no one wants you to see, you have a 15-minute long conversation about like faith or politics. So I was asking the questions, like for me personally, one thing that was really important for me was to talk about like what life after the show could look like. Like I wasn't going on the show just to like get wrapped up in the fame per se. And like, you know, I'm not a model. I'm not like comfortable with photo shoots. Like, so I really wanted somebody who had ambition and drive. And wanted to still have that after the show and have something that they wanted to work towards for themselves. So like, for instance, Ari and I talked about like what life would look like after the show. Obviously he was living in Arizona. I was living in Minnesota. And so, and I was working in public relations and it's something that I wanted to go back to after the season and still have a job. And so we had talked about that, like, you know, if you were to move to Arizona, what kind of PR agency could you get a job at and where would we live and like how many kids do you want, stuff like that. So I don't think that ever made it to TV. But we definitely sat down and had those conversations closer to the end too. Like once I knew I was one of the contestants in the running, I really got down and dirty and heavy with more of those in-depth questions. And I'm assuming like, especially in fantasy suites, when you're away from the cameras and have, you know, a full night to talk to this other person about certain things that are important. I did that during my time and I can imagine other people would too. Hopefully if they really want to find a good partner for them, a good match for them.
But I always wonder that too, like the fantasy suites. Like, I think that the viewers, especially the younger ones, are probably like, the door closes and it's like a hot time in the city. But I'm thinking as a woman, like an educated woman who's like had a professional experience, I close the door and I'm like, all right, let's get to it. What are your in-laws nuts? And like, if I do live in that city, like there's not much of an industry for my job. Like, I would think that I, like we joke, like you were an older contestant, which is insane because you weren't even that old when you did it. But is the fantasy suite really more like, let's work out the kinks. Like, what are we going to need to work on in a relationship? And less about, let's disrobe and like get it on.
I mean, it's honestly probably different for every contestant. I can't speak for any other lead and their time in the fantasy suite because I'm not them, obviously. But for me, and this is something I've talked to Rachel, my co-host on the Bachelor Happy Hour podcast about, is like you have to utilize your time. Like, of course, for me, like intimacy and getting close to someone in that regard is important. So that's the first time you have the opportunity to finally do that on the show. But also too, like I talked about my political beliefs and how I'm very outspoken as an advocate for women and certain things that were important to me in that aspect. And so for me personally, those were conversations that I had. And in terms of like the in-laws, I had already had, when I was the lead, I had already met the families and my, you know, my potential in-laws. And so I kind of felt comfortable with them in terms of like, how would I fit into their family? How would I assimilate into their family life? Now I don't, like I said, I can't speak for everyone. So like, you know, I'm sure some bachelors go in and like you said, it's hot and heavy and that's all they kind of want to focus their time on. So like for me, it was a balance. It was having those deep conversations, asking the right questions. Like one thing for me too, that was really important was to know if people have debt, because like if I'm going to get engaged to somebody, like I want to know kind of like what your financial status is. Like if I were to be taking you on in my life, like how would that affect me? And so that was one thing that I had, you know, and I kind of like brought it up jokingly, like, I know this is our first like sleepover, but these are things that are important to me. So, and I know Rachel did the same thing. Like she went in, I think with a checklist and her list of questions that she had to knock off before, like she could get to the next level with the guys. And like I said, we talked about that on the podcast, but it's different for everyone. I think maybe for some younger contestants or maybe some of the guys, it's, you know, it's more about the physical aspect, but to each their own. And you have one night to have these conversations. So I really tried to utilize my time to the best that I could in the short amount that I was given.
So then like a couple years have gone by now. And when you think about that scene, the breakup scene with Ari, if you were to go outside of yourself, I mean, do you kind of look at that scene, look back at each other with a little bit more grace? Like, these are two people that didn't really know each other that well, and obviously were not the greatest fit, and that you take the anger out of it, maybe because time has gone on and you've had a relationship since then.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's no anger, and like, and I don't really think there was much anger. It was more so like, for me, it was just how things played out. Like the way that he chose to handle things, I was more upset with, but at the end of the day, like, he wasn't for me, and that's fine. And I told him this during our finale on live television. I was like, I would never want anyone to feel like they were stuck or forced into a relationship with me. And so I want everyone to be happy and to follow their hearts. And yeah, at the end of the day, like, we weren't each other's person. It ended a lot more quickly than I obviously had expected going into that. But I mean, at this point, he's happy. I'm happy.
It probably
would not have worked out in the long run. I'm just going to be honest with that. Everything does happen for a reason. It was more so the way that it went down that was the hard part for me to struggle with, like with a lack of emotion and really like no communication on the other end. It's like, what, that happened 3 years ago, close to 3 years ago now. Like, it's water under the bridge at this point.
So when you're the Bachelorette do you feel incredible pressure to not only make the right decision because you're going to be on the cover of magazines and then you're going to have to do all these interviews? I'm sure there's part of it that, like, I don't want to disappoint my family. But I feel like a lot of people don't talk about the pressure that comes with a woman being on television. You were just a working professional. You didn't have any dreams of being like a television host. And then you have to be camera ready all the time. And then you have trolls talking about the way that you look. What is that like, that pressure? And how did you handle it? And what's your advice maybe for other young women who are in similar situations, like how not to, how to disallow that pressure to get to them mentally?
Yeah, I mean, there is a ton of pressure, and much more than I could have ever fathomed taking on the role as a bachelorette. You know, I said yes to it to meet men that I probably would never have the opportunity to meet, and to explore all of these different relationships. I didn't really think about the back end of what it would look like via social media comments and through comments from my interviews that I gave. So there's definitely a lot of pressure. I will say this. I did not feel pressure from the show to get engaged and find the right person. Like, they of course wanted that to happen and they want people to find love. But at the end of the day too, like, I formed some really special close bonds with a lot of people that work on the show that they just want you to be happy. But outside of that, yeah, it's a lot. And it's definitely so easy to get wrapped up in going on social media and reading the comments and reading the DMs and going on forums and seeing what people are saying about you, from everything from what you said to how you interacted with a man that you were having a relationship with, to the clothes that you wear, to how you style your hair, down to your eyelashes. Like, it's astronomical, and that's a world that I wasn't used to. And so I think for me, I took breaks from social media. Like, when the show was airing, I really didn't go on social media that much because I didn't want to get sucked into that. Like, you get a lot of good comments, you get a lot of hate. So I really wanted to balance it out and be like, these people don't actually know me. They're seeing 2 hours of a snippet of my life every Monday. And so I tried to stay away from social media for a little bit. I think, especially as a woman, but for men too, it's very easy to compare yourself and to get down. And so, even to this day, like, I find myself still trying to take breaks from social media when I can. If I feel like it's not going to serve me, or if I'm just going to go down a rabbit hole, or I'm going to get, you know, like, just sucked in a negative way, then I don't even allow myself to go on to Instagram for a day or for a week. And like, when I was going through my recent breakup, I didn't go on Instagram for more than a month because I was like, this isn't going to serve me right now. It's not going to help me. And so, one bit of advice that and I've told a couple of the bachelorettes that came after me, I told both Hannah and Claire this, is like, just stay off social media. Like, enjoy this moment because this is your moment. Your show is airing. You know, people are excited to watch you and see who you hopefully fall in love with. But, like, don't go on social media. Don't go on the Reddits. Don't, like, read trashy magazine articles about you. Just, like, focus on you and your relationship, because at the end of the day, that's the only lasting thing. And that's, like, hopefully what you can put all of your time and energy and heart and commitment into, because the rest of it will fade and fall and not matter. So don't get sucked into it and don't let it affect your heart. Yeah, so that's what I would tell anyone, really.
Now that the show has been on, like, you've been off there for a little bit, you're still kind of in the bachelor world, but are you more likely to meet the man that you marry by that this way? So you've got 3 options: someone in Bachelor Nation, somebody who works in television production, or somebody who's totally outside of the television world.
Well, right now I am so not even thinking about that, about dating and being in a relationship, that, like, that's so far from my mind that at this point it's like not even an option. For me right now, like, I just went through a breakup. I just went through a move across the country again. And so I know, like, I need time for myself, and I want to take that time and to explore, like, me and my opportunities and, like, what I truly want to, like, fill in my life before I'm ready for that next step again. And so one day, whenever it happens, I'm not going to I don't want to say how I'm going to meet someone, because who knows if I'm going to be living in LA or not. For me right now, I just want to have a relationship with myself. And I've never really said that or been in that mind space before. So I really want to just sit in this for a while and explore me and what fills me first before even thinking about dating and meeting anyone else.
Don't you think it would be somewhat gratifying to be on an episode like a hometown visit, but just be in the bushes, or to be some family member in the background that offers unsolicited advice, given the experience that you've had? I mean, do you watch these episodes and are you screaming at the TV like we are?
Oh, 1,000%. Well, so yeah, I have to watch each episode because I recap it for my podcast. So I'm still very much invested, especially when it comes to the Bachelorettes, because all of us form this really special bond. We have chats all the time. And so I feel I get really close with them. And so I of course want them to ask the right questions, want them to find the best potential person for them. I always joke with the producers, who I'm still really close with, that I would love to be on their team. I would love to be producer to ask the right questions, because I kind of know what goes into it at this point. But I don't think anyone would want me as a family member, because I think I would be way too invested and way too judgmental and be well, no one's good enough for my person. And so I don't think that would be conducive to anyone. But I'm always here for the contestants and the leads if they ever have questions or just want to vent. I try to reach out to them before their season airs, and as you know, before they even leave for filming, just to be a shoulder to lean on if they need it. So I'm always going to hopefully be that person. And I think a lot of the leads are like that too, for the others that come to follow them.
Okay. So tell everybody where they can find you on social media, where they can catch up with you.
So I'm very active on Instagram. I don't really use Facebook or Twitter that much, but, Instagram, you can find me at bkoof, KOOF. That's where I have all of my label information. I'm also going to be soon announcing a very exciting project, hopefully in the next week or two. So check me out there and stay tuned. And you can, my email and sign up to get, notifications for what I will soon be launching.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time. Jonathan, new Unsolved Mysteries Volume 2. Are you ready for some of these cases?
I couldn't be more ready.
Okay. Washington Insider Murder. So Jack Wheeler's body is found on December 30th, 2010 in the Cherry Island landfill in Delaware. He was a decorated veteran. He was apparently killed by blunt force trauma, according to the Delaware State Medical Examiner's Office. Not only is it unclear what exactly caused his injury, but the reasons behind his erratic behavior days before his body was found remain elusive. So following his death, there was a video of Jack Wheeler a day emerged showing the 66-year-old looking disoriented while wearing only one shoe. So according to the Washington Post, he was seemingly trying to gain access to a garage, claiming he needed to pay a parking fee. Wheeler also claimed his briefcase had been stolen. So on the same day, he approached a pharmacist in the area asking for a ride to Wilmington, Delaware. And then on the 30th of December, when he was last sighted alive, he was seen wandering outside several office buildings looking confused and disoriented at 8:30 p.m. So 14 hours later, his body was found. His house was a mess. It looks like somebody had broken into it. How did he die, and what caused his strange behavior?
So what I keep seeing for him, it sucks, but it's early stage of paranoia is the best way I can explain it. But it's also mixed with mental illness I see with him. So it's you have the paranoia, then you have some type of personality disorder with him. And I see kind of what caused his death. I keep seeing they keep tapping his chest, and I keep seeing it wasn't due to someone else. So no one else put their hands on him. No one else did anything. It seems a lot, from what I'm looking and tapping into with this right now, it really seems it has a lot to do with him maybe taking prescription drugs or too many of some type of drug. Cause it seems he keeps tapping his head saying he was losing his mind. He was losing his mind. mixed with like mental illness.
So he was not murdered, but how did he end up in the landfill?
I personally think that he was extremely disoriented and he was just going all over the place from what I see. But like the landfill thing, I think it was just him wandering off and just ended up there. Like, I don't think he was murdered in any way, because he keeps saying a lot of it was like self-harm, like meaning like, I guess, doing drugs and not drugs, but like prescription stuff maybe, and just paranoid.
The next one, a death in Oslo. So a murder was seemingly carried out at the Plaza Hotel in Oslo, Norway. So it's this luxury hotel. It's got 37 floors, and it's known for this mysterious murder of this unidentified woman in 1995. So she checks in under the name Jennifer Fergate. Her death was officially ruled a suicide, with the woman discovered holding a Browning 9mm pistol. However, according to Norwegian paper Verdens Gang, soon details about the case became more intriguing. Firstly, no gunshot residue or blood was found on her hands, indicating she didn't fire the pistol. Secondly, the serial number of the gun was removed and no fingerprints were found on the weapon. All labels were also removed from her clothes. So it's not clear if the woman was actually called Jennifer Fergate either, because there was no ID or a passport found with the body. And although the case was publicized at the time, the body has never been identified.
That's crazy. Let me tap in. Yeah, no, the first thing that I see is that it definitely was not a suicide at all. The woman who's kind of stepping forward to me as well, her name is not, it doesn't seem like it is Jennifer, whatever, Fergate. It doesn't look like that. It kind of, it looks like, she keeps showing, the woman keeps showing me like an S sounding name and keeps like, you know, extending it. So I don't know if it's like a foreign name, but what she's also saying too, she's pouring, I'm not saying that this is it. It just seems like she was poisoned. Like, it seems like that's how she passed away. Like, it's either she was poisoned or it's like something along the lines like that. That's what I see with her. It's very interesting because she's also coming through saying, it's like, I don't know if she dated someone that was affiliated with nasty people, but that's what it seems like, her personal life and being with someone who's like, I'm not saying it's a gang because it doesn't have to be, it could be literally anyone, but it seems like these people were not great people.
So is this a revenge killing, like, you've done something to me and we're going to punish you? Or
it seems like it's some type of revenge, but it has nothing to do with her, it has to do with the person she was with.
And why hasn't that person come forward? It's because they're culpable in some way.
I think it's because they did some, from what I see, she keeps putting bars in front of me. So he did a lot of stuff that could potentially put him in jail. Like, if even if he did come forward. Like, even if he did come forward and be like, hey, like, this is my mess. Seems like he would be in there for a while.
So somebody came into the room, but somehow the door was locked, double bolt locked. How were they able to do that? So she's poisoned, but there was a gunshot wound, and then the door's double bolted. So how were they able to do that? Like,
I just think that there's like many escape plans and stuff. So I think like maybe they did something. I'm not saying escape plan where it's like elaborate, where they have like ropes and stuff. Mm. I just think they were just able to escape and lock from the inside and leave, you know, from that. Like,
and when she went to the hotel, did she know that something was going to happen, or was she totally blindsided?
Nope. Totally blindsided.
Wow. Totally blindsided
because she's still. Like, from me tapping in, it's still a very big shock to her. I mean, she was, like, blindsided.
Okay, next one, stolen kids. Christopher Dansby was last seen in New York City on a playground May 18th, 1989. According to the Charlie Project, which publicizes cold cases of missing people, 2-year-old Christopher had been with his mother in the playground on the day of his disappearance, needing to pick up food at a nearby store and not having a stroller with her. She left Christopher with relatives at the park. When returning a half an hour later, her son was missing. So where did he go?
So this is my question. Because he's not dead. So, like, that's the thing. I don't see him being dead. I see him being literally like the title Stolen Kids. Like, it looks like he was kidnapped, or it looks like he was taken, but it also looks like he was so young that he doesn't know. Like, you know what I mean?
Well, I think they said that a 7-year-old boy allegedly witnessed him walking up a nearby street later in the day, according to an eyewitness, an unidentified man.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, because it looks like it looks like he was taken.
And taken, like, to be assaulted, or taken just to, like, you're going to live with another family.
You're going to live with another family.
Oh, that is so heartbreaking. But he's alive.
I don't see him dead. Like, I don't see an energy for a young kid that's taken. Like, wow. I don't see that. But I also see, like, with me tapping into his biological family, that someone took him not to assault and do awful things, but to literally raise him as if it was their own type of situation.
And like, do we know a state that he's living in, or an area? And does he know that he was taken?
Does he know he's taking? No. Doesn't look like that. And it kind of looks like it's around, I know it sounds weird, Delaware. Looks like fairly close. It doesn't look like it's too far away. Like, it looks like pretty neighboring to, like, New York. Doesn't look like it's, like, crazy far.
Well, that's the good thing, is that with this show, maybe someone will recognize his photo.
That's what I'm assuming. What's going to happen?
Wow. Okay, Lady in the Lake. Joanne Romaine disappeared after attending church in Michigan in January of 2010. Her body was eventually found 70 days later floating in the icy Detroit River, 30 miles from the church. Although the death was officially ruled a suicide, the Detroit Free Press reports that Joanne's daughter, Michelle, disputes this. After hiring several private investigators and pathologists, Michelle says several findings emerged that should open up the case.
It kind of looks like also, too, with her. Doesn't look like, I mean, I know they said that she drowned, but it also kind of looks like it's like drowning without water, if that makes sense. It's called like dry drowning, I think, where it's basically like a drowning effect without water. So, for example, it's like, you know, like how they used to torture people, put like a rag and pour water on you to like, oh, okay, like dry drowning like that. And that's why I see what it is, because I don't see it was a suicide. Like, I do not see that. And she's not, typically when someone comes through as a suicide for me right away, they take acknowledgement for their death, which means like a suicide and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, they're acknowledging that like they're the reason why that they passed away. Like, they, you know, took the life. And she's not coming through like that. She's coming through as like the hands of someone else type of situation.
Mm-hmm. So, did she know the person that did this to her?
Yeah, it's kind of close to them. Like, it's kind of close. And she, I don't know if she was a, like a crazy big, like religious type of family, cause it, or whatever. Cause it kind of looks like it has to do with someone who's heavily involved in a religious type of thing. So whether like a church, synagogue, or whatever, it seems like it's like someone in, I don't know if they're heavily religious, but they're involved in some type of like religious, like whether they work for the church, help the church out, help the synagogue, whatever religion. That's what I see with that. And I hope I'm wrong. I do, because like that's, from what I see, is like very messed up. That's the best way I'll explain it.
Tsunami spirits. There have been numerous ghost sightings in Ishinomaki, Japan, following a devastating tsunami in 2011. So there's been an exorcist that has reportedly seen undead spirits in the area. Do you think in cases like this, where there's been mass tragedies, are spirits kind of floating around? Do they remain trapped in the place where they passed away?
So I don't think they don't remain trapped. Like, that's not what happens. They definitely go back to where sometimes like tragic events have happened. So like, that's why people will be like, I moved into this house and there's stuff in my house. And then when I read them and I give them like information, they find out that someone passed away in their home. And typically what happens is the energy will kind of flock back to where a tragic event happened to them. But they typically are around their family, but they will go back to tragic events. For example, like a tsunami is pretty freaking tragic. Mm-hmm. So like that's, and it's an intense one as well, but like they definitely go back, for sure go back.
The last one is death row fugitive. So Lester Eubanks was convicted of murdering 14-year-old Mary Ellen Denier. Although serving time on death row for several years, he escaped police custody in 1975 and has been on the run ever since. Is he still alive?
No. No, he's not. Yeah, no, he's not. Because someone who's coming through specifically for that, he's taking acknowledgement for... It's not just her, it seems like he did stuff too. It seems like other people as well. And this person's taking acknowledgement for that. And typically when someone does that, they're owning up to their mistakes. And yeah, he's passed away.
Ugh, that's terrible. When you watch shows like this, it's like you hear the voices and you see the imagery as it unfolds on screen?
Not so much, just because it happens so fast. Like, I definitely get, like, feelings from it, and I definitely get, like, you know, once I really tap in. But it's mostly, like, if I read someone that's involved in that and I have them face-to-face, that's when I get the most, like, specific, direct information for them versus, like, a show. Because, like, I feel like sometimes with the show, they'll change, like, kind of like the narrative with, like, some things and make things a little bit more, like, exaggerated than it is. So it's hard for me to, like, really pinpoint, like, stuff, because you don't know, like, what's true and what's not true, like, fully. But when I have the person in front of me, then it becomes very specific and very, like, detailed.
And of all the people that you read, what unsolved mystery are you asked most often about?
That's a good question. I think it really depends on which unsolved mystery is, like, quote-unquote hot at the moment.
Yeah.
So... It really depends. Like, you have people from so many different, it's typically a lot of missing people. Most of the time, the ones I find interesting are the ones that don't break the local news. Like, the ones that are, like, it'd be like a small town in, like, Virginia, this person's been missing, and it just stays within their local news and doesn't go, like, national. And, like, those are the ones that I like to do the most, because there's not a lot of limelight on it. So I could really get into the nitty gritty of, like, you know, the family, the police and stuff, and really, like, do stuff with them and really help them out. The people that are in small towns that are struggling, that don't break the local news, because there's a lot of them. Like, I'm telling you, I read a lot of them.
And the one case I don't think I've ever asked you about, I don't know if you could do it off the cuff, but Madeline McCann, that little blonde girl that was stolen from the resort in Portugal.
It seems like it has something to do where there's a hiccup within the family, but I don't know if she was alone in a hotel room.
There were other siblings and they were asleep, but they had gone back. They had been checking every 30 minutes, walking back up to the room, but the adults were having dinner quite a distance away. So they left the kids in the room and then they would come back and check periodically.
Oh, because it seems like it was all orchestrated. And it seems like it was something that was planned, and it doesn't seem like it was something that was random, because to me, from what keeps coming through, it was the perfect plan. And I know it sounds weird to say, but it seems like it was perfectly executed.
Yeah.
Like, there was no hiccup. There was no disturbance. It was perfectly executed. And that's what I keep seeing. And I keep seeing that, honestly, and no one should point fingers at obviously anyone, but it seems like there was a huge family hiccup with it, because it seems like there were so many of her family members, from what she's showing me. There's so many family members.
Does the energy read as someone that's passed or someone that may have been alive and taken for reasons of, like, sex trafficking or something like that?
If I'm kind of, like, really going off of what I see and stuff, it looks like she has passed away.
And it's just like a man at the resort who had just been watching them. Is it a man and like two other people helping, or is it just on his own?
No, it looks like he was very much kind of orchestrated. So it looks like there was people involved, more than one. Doesn't look like it was an individual. And the reason why I'm saying that is because she keeps repeating to me and showing me kind of in my head a perfect execution, not good enough for one man. Like, there's no way one man could pull this off. Like, there's no way, because what she's showing me, there's no tracks of, like, anything, like, no, any, like, there's not much to go off of, is what she's telling me, like, very little.
So, wow, that makes sense. That's why it's been so hard to figure out what happened, because it was so well done.
I heard of it, actually. I never looked into it. Once someone told me it was a little girl, like, it just breaks my heart. So, like, I didn't really want to look. It's just, like, too sad. I mean, like, all of them are sad, but this seems even worse to me.
So how can people follow you? Well, first of all, am I the biggest pain in the ass friend? Am I the one that texts you the most with stupid questions?
No, I love talking to you. No way. No, way. I'm probably the pain in the ass. I always reach out to you.
No. But if people want to get a reading with you, and people ask me all the time, how can I find Jonathan? The best way to find you is on Instagram. So how can they find you on Instagram?
Just Jonathan Mark Medium. That's like, that's where everyone kind of goes to find me now. Like, that's like the number one spot.
Are you going to get shirts monogrammed with JMM?
Probably not. No. No way. Yeah.
Can I get like a sun visor for the beach to cover my CO2 facial face with JMM?
Sure. I'll definitely get you one of those.
Perfect. All right. So just Instagram. And what's your website?
My website is jonathanmark.net.
Perfect.
Very easy.
Perfect. Thank you a million times.
No, thank you. I love this.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my incredible guests, Becca Cuffrin and Jonathan Mark, and remind you guys, it's so important to click on subscribe and to leave a 5-star review. You can jump in the Facebook group, talk about this episode and other episodes. Go back and check out some of the old episodes. Like, some of my favorites include episode 121, where I interviewed the director and producer of some of the greatest shows like Rock of Love, Flavor of Love. He also created Below Deck. That one, that episode makes me laugh so hard. Or Kathy Kleiner, who I interviewed, who survived an attack by Ted Bundy. She was one of the sorority sisters at FSU and survived it and can live to tell. And she's just an astounding person. Or, you know, even recent episodes like the mother of Wells Crowther, who is featured in the documentary Man with a Red Bandana. He saved 18 people on 9/11 in the World Trade Center South Tower. So go back and listen to old episodes too, and you can talk about that in the Facebook group and kind of what's going on shows right now that are filming and that are airing. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. Now, I'm tweeting throughout the week about things I'm watching, what to look for, and on my Twitter and in my Facebook group and my Instagram is at Kate Casey CA. I will post for you every week a list of must-watch shows. I love this list. I'm really excited about it. People are sharing it, which is so fantastic. And, you know, just a great thing to do to look for new and exciting content, especially if you're sick of watching the same shows all the time. So please check out for that. And then my Patreon page. Some of you are like, what are you talking about, Patreon? So you go to Patreon, the website, patreon.com/KateCasey. There are bonus episodes, and I do a lot of life anecdotes, stories about my first marriage, and that was a doozy. Go back and listen to that one. Going to that boarding school in Hershey, Pennsylvania, about I had a boyfriend in high school that committed suicide. Some stories about that. But also I do a lot of true crime ones. There's one this week about the greatest con story that I ever heard about. His name was Clark Rockefeller, and it's a real doozy. So anyway, go back and check out the Patreon because there are a lot of crossover episodes with other podcast hosts and some great extra stuff. So check that out. I'm hoping that you guys have a great week, and I'm so excited to circle back with you on Friday, especially if Dan manages to get any video or photos. Again, let's keep our expectations low, but there's a part of me that holds a candle. There's mildly hopeful. Meanwhile, it's probably a commercial for like a Japanese company for all we know, but it's funny nonetheless. Again, have a great week. Circle back with you on Friday.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.